All right, this is the hour, Conversations with Linda. She's also looking for some more breaking information on any major story you want her to cover. So fire away, and back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. We've got Linda Moulton Howe, and we're going to take your phone calls as well. Linda, how have you been lately, by the way? Haven't even had a chance to ask you.
Well, gosh, after England, I came back, and it seems like I have been running ever since just to catch up. There has been so much news breaking, and I will have tomorrow or by Sunday a fascinating story from Canada of a crop formation that was in Stettler, and it actually goes back to August 25th when it was discovered. But I have been learning a great deal from many people there who were in it, and this is one of those formations where right at the beginning, people put their hands down to the soil and found that where the wheat coming out of the ground in the Stettler formation had no wrinkles, no creases, no breaks on either side. And that, right from the get-go, is one of those extraordinary signatures that something very strange happened in that formation. And I'm bringing this up because here we are about to go into October, but this is the season in which wheat is still growing in Canada, and we have had Moose Jaw also had a fascinating formation just reported. And so Canada is now the place where I have more to report, even on crop formation.
Okay, let's go to some of the phones. We go to Sedona, Arizona. Who is it? It's got to be you, Blair. Go ahead.
Hi, George. Hi, Linda.
Hello.
I have one comment and a question for you, Linda. The comment is, if this is truly a government by the people and for the people, how about us practicing an economics that may be termed Christian capitalism? In other words, I forgive your usury, you forgive my debt.
Right now, I think that the government of the United States is becoming unrecognizable to those of us who grew up in a different time. And I guess the idea of controlling a population by keeping its nose to the grindstone so that endless taxes would be there for whatever the elected and unelected authorities want to spend it on has been a long-time issue, not just related to cover-up and black budgets in the phenomena that we're discussing tonight. And right now, if I understand your question going forward, is what kind of a nation are we now, and is there anything that the unelected power greed people, is there anything that those who are not in the power greed echelon can do to change anything any longer in this nation when votes don't seem to accomplish much?
Okay, thank you, Blair. Let's go now to Kingwood, West Virginia. Scott, first-time caller. Hey, Scotty, go ahead.
Hey, George. Love the show.
Thank you.
Well, the airman that you had on with the cylindrical craft.
Right.
Now, 1990 through 93, I was a radar operator. I was stationed in Germany. So I was used to being around airstrips and aircraft. And when I came back here, I started doing the large paper routes. And one morning, a little late, it was May of 97. There was a side road, and I just felt something, and above me, you kind of look out through the front of the windshield of the vehicle, and I could see something above me. And at first, I thought it was a large airship, coming like it paralleled with me, or right above me. So I actually stopped the vehicle and got out and looked, and it just really, really slowly above me. It sounded exactly like the thing that the airman was describing. It was cylindrical. The only difference was there was like a I guess you'd call it a midline along the cigar shape, and it had very small lighting along the midline, and there was like a only the only way I could describe it, the tail seemed like a comet's tail to me. But it was very, very low. The thing wasn't, it was no more than 100 feet above my head.
And you didn't hear anything?
No, ma'am, I did not. It was silent. That was the eerie part. It was very disturbing not hearing any engine noise.
Couldn't this have been a blimp? What were you seeing that separated this into a different category from a blimp?
I watched it for, I'll say a quick minute, because you kind of lose track of the time. It couldn't have been very long, a minute or so. And it continued on the heading that it was going, straight, more or less down the roadway that I was going. It was heading in an easterly direction. And as it got about, I'll say, 500 to 600 feet in front of me and the 100 feet above me, it shot off at a 90-degree angle almost fast enough that I couldn't see what it was, and then it was gone. That was I've never seen an airship do that.
Right, that's not a blimp. And that reminds me of Sergeant Peniston saying about what that triangle, when it started glowing white, rose up to treetop level. And then from his point of view, it was literally gone in a second or two. And he said, I don't know of anything that can go from where it was to nothing in a second or two.
Linda, yesterday, quite a program. We had Eric Von Daniken in, of course, author, Chariots of the Gods.
Right.
And Simeon Hine was on talking about crop formations. He says hello, by the way.
And, well, he and I have a serious disagreement. I think he is with the people who think it's fine to go out into the fields and make the formations, and I disagree.
Right. But he believes that some of them are coming from strange and unusual sources.
Well, that's good. I'm glad he's reinforcing it because there's no question, even from a pure scientific point of view of biophysical and biochemical changes and what happens in the soil, we're dealing with phenomena. The question is, what is the source?
What is the source? Next up, we go to Portland, Maine, east of the Rockies. Good morning, Richard.
Hey, George. You're the Night Hawk still. You'll always be the Night Hawk. And Linda Moten, wow, it's a pleasure to talk to you. I had a question for you about what was brought up about failure to debrief the gentleman.
Right.
And how the military's emphasis was on interrogating them instead.
Right.
Me, this raises questions to whether this was an extraterrestrial spaceship or possibly a top secret project of some sort. And I have one more question that was really raised by Mr. Richard Hoagland earlier when he talked about the discovery of water on the moon. And I don't see how this might give, that it could lead to give credibility that we quite possibly never have been there. I mean, how could we have missed something so important and so obvious a clue? And take answers off the air if you don't mind.
All right, thanks. I read the report that went into Science, and we're not talking about liquid water running on the moon. The moon is drier than any desert on Earth, but what they have been able to confirm is a molecular presence, a molecule, that a molecule of water would be sitting on the surface. This was the surprise of the moon dirt. That doesn't mean that you could scoop up water, liquid water. You would have to take, I think that there was a statistic, and I have it at Earth Files, that you would have to take many, many yards of the soil just to get some ounces if you had put together all these molecules. But the significance about this is they didn't know that they were going to find molecular levels of water just sitting on the surface of the moon, which means that it is a more dynamic place than we had thought. And it now redirects the attention to the shadowy craters that have never been exposed to sunshine. Those craters might contain a lot more water. And in fact, I think it's October 9th, NASA is going to slam one of its orbiting satellites into the South Pole. And the idea is to go into a particular crater there that, as far as they know, has not been exposed to the sun. And they're going to use this satellite to smash into that crater to see if can they bounce out some water ice from that crater? If they do, it means that setting up some kind of a base, especially in the south pole of the moon, where they have the Shackleton crater, has sunlight, if I remember correctly, something like 99% of the time. And that means that you could have solar power going all of the time in that south pole. And if they actually can find water ice in those craters, we have the beginnings, perhaps, of what would be substantial coming together of things that we would need for a base. And that's what they're now trying to do and to see. So it is not that the moon has lots of undiscovered water. It was that at a molecular level, on the surface of the dirt, that they found molecules of water. That was the surprise.
Okay, next up, let's go to Louisville, Kentucky. Hey, Mike, you're on with Linda. Go ahead, Mike. Yeah.
Oh, hi, George. Thank you for taking my call. I appreciate
it. Sure thing.
Linda, I wanted to tell you a little, short experience that my wife and I had, my late wife, by the way, several years back, right here in front of our own house.
Where are you?
Louisville, Kentucky. I live in a suburban area of Louisville.
Okay.
We saw something, and I brought my wife's attention to it. She was always kind of skeptical about the existence of these things until she saw this. It was a odd rod-shaped, it almost looked like a stick of neon light. And mind you, at the time, this was midwinter. The sky was clear. There was no, no haze or no fog. In fact, there was no weather of any significance going on at all at that time. And it was about, I'd say, maybe 1 o'clock in the morning. And I saw this thing, what in the world, is that? And it was hanging just a little bit above the horizon level. But it was stationary. It didn't move. But it looked like a, like I said, like a rod of neon light. It was almost a neon orange-red.
And how far was it from you?
To be honest with you, it was kind of hard to determine. It could have been, close, or it could have been, extremely large and some distance away. It really was hard for me to calculate. But I'm a retired physics teacher, and I thought of all the scenarios as to what it could be. And I thought, well, reflection from the ground, no, there was no mist or anything like that, no clouds. Some type of strange ionization in the atmosphere. I thought maybe that might be the case. But this was too perfectly shaped. It was a straight rod, and it went, vertical, up and down.
Mm-hmm.
And it just stood, remained motionless, but it was this real orangish red that sometimes changed to a bright, brilliant a crimson red. And then I'd say maybe after a period of about, we looked at this thing for about 10 minutes. It winked out, just like that. Now, my question to you, have you ever heard of any such UFO as this, the one that I just described? It sounds like the typical cigar-shaped craft, but this was seen at night, so I couldn't see anything. I couldn't see any background shape of the thing, only the light.
Right. And it was vertical in the sky. And one of the things over the decades that people have reported occasionally is that they will see something that looks like perhaps a disc, a narrow disc, maybe a lens shape horizontal in the sky. And then the whole thing will tip up vertically right before their eyes.
Right.
And the most dramatic case that I have ever heard was Stephenville, Texas. This was back in just a year. It was January of 2008.
It was a great case. That's the one we did the sci-fi show on. Remember
well,
that?
And exactly. And at Earth Files, I did a very in-depth report with one of the patrol officers who did this beautiful computer illustration. He was down at City Hall, and he was on the radio with some people, and he drew this enormous, he estimated maybe it was 2 or 3 football fields long. If it was 3, it would be at least 900 feet. And to his complete and total shock, this horizontal we'll call it like something cigar-shaped with appendages, turns vertically up in the air, and this was the detail that impressed this law officer was. If you can imagine something horizontal in the air like an airplane, an airplane doing acrobatics would never be able to pivot right in exactly the spot that the wing would just lift up and the whole plane would lift like it was on a hinge. That is not something that we would do. And yet this enormous thing over the Stephenville courthouse, according to the law officer, seemed to pivot on a point that never moved, going up vertically in the sky. That is a physics that defies understanding, actually. So that kind of vertical, horizontal to vertical, that has been described. And the one thing I was thinking of as you were speaking was a photograph from Billy Meier in the Switzerland-Austria area back in the 1970s. And I know that there have been all kinds of attacks on the Billy Meier case, but I remember talking with Jacques Vallée back in 1979 after he had made a trip there and had looked at the 35-millimeter negatives. That's what they were then, not digital.
And Jacques is a tough guy.
Jacques is a very tough guy. I respect him very much. And he said, Linda, I'm looking at real craft, real photos, real 35-millimeter. This is not something that somebody had put together back then in the 70s in their film. This was 35-millimeter, and he was convinced it was real. And Billy Meier had a photograph of a horizontal tube, looks exactly like a tube of light, that was whitish-green, that he said came up close to the front door of his house, and he went out and took a photograph of it.
Amazing stuff, Linda. I mean, what keeps driving you for these answers? You don't give up.
No, I that's not in my nature, and I think the one dominating character of my personality is I have always been so curious. My mom and dad told me that when I was 2 or 3 years old, they had taken me to a fair, and they had sat down and got hot dogs, and there was a reporter from a local newspaper in the town where we were living who was sitting at this table, and this apparently made it into the newspaper when this little 2 or 3 year old said, Mom, what kind of bees make mustard? And I was associating putting the mustard on the hot dog with putting honey that we did on toast. And I think it's that kind of curiosity of always looking for patterns in things and wanting to understand everything that there is on the earth and in this universe. I really would like to understand it all.
Linda, when we come back and we'll take final phone calls, I also want to ask you, what got you into the area of high strangeness? I mean, you've been a television producer, documentary filmmaker, you've been a talent, you've done TV. What got you to go into this specific area? Because as you know, we all have evolved from the hard news end, but we always migrate to what we cared about, what we loved, or what our passion was, and that's to investigate the unusual, the mysteries, the supernatural. More with Linda Moulton Howe on Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Norrie. Back in a moment. Well, on our next Coast to Coast program, Friday into Saturday morning, we're going live to the Philippines. Art Bell, gracious enough to sit in for me. So he'll be doing that program. So that'll be a treat. And then we'll talk about some more schedules coming up in the next few weeks on Coast to Coast AM. So, Linda, what got you into covering these kinds of stories when you came out of a hard news background?
While I was in a hard news background, it was the animal mutilations. I was director of special projects at the CBS station in Denver. It was the summer of 1979, and I was producing a documentary on something completely different, but my audio guy had just come off of a 2020 shoot. That program had just started back then, and my crew would be people who, they worked in L.A., they worked all over the place, and then I would hire them for projects I was doing in Colorado. And so Mark O'Kane had come off that 2020 shoot, and he was telling me that they were trying to get to the bottom of what was killing and mutilating animals, and where they had been concentrating was a state out in the Midwest, and that he had a hard time keeping the battery belts going. And for people who may not remember, when we were working in double system 16 millimeter with an Agra that was running a quarter inch, and then you'd have to sync it up to edit between your film and putting the quarter inch into full code, it was vital when you were with a crew in the field that you had to have, let's say, sometimes 8 to 10 battery belts that you could keep changing, and the cameraman or the audio guy would be wearing those belts to power your equipment. And this was the lifeline for those of us working in field documentaries. And Mark is telling me that here he is on an ABC network shoot, and they couldn't keep any of their battery belts charged. And I said, well, what do you mean you couldn't keep them charged? He said, you know me. He said, I'm so conscientious, and I would make sure every battery belt ran all night, and we would get out into one of these pastures with one of these animals, and not a single one of our battery belts would work. Well, listening to that as a producer and director of special projects at the CBS station, he really had my attention, because I wanted to understand what in the world would drain battery belts out in a field. So I called up the executive producer that was working on 2020, explained who I was and that Mark O'Kane was working for me, and he said that they had shot over 100,000 feet of double system for a 2020 story on animal mutilations, and when was it going to air? And I was so surprised to hear an answer from the New York executive. He said, no, we've scrubbed that story. We're in the business of news, and we could never come up with an answer. And that was the beginning, when I heard that the ABC network was trashing 100,000 feet of double system because they couldn't come up with an answer. I thought, wow, I've got to find out what's going on with these animals. And in a way, it's 30 years later, and I'm on the same kind of path with the same intense curiosity, but it has gone way beyond animal mutilations, which are a part, as far as I have been told by law enforcement, who they were convinced when I began the research. They're the ones who were telling me we're dealing with creatures from outer space. And so in a funny way, RAF Bentwaters today is an extension of all of that work that I began in 1979.
Perfect. Let's go to Jane in Boston, Massachusetts. First-time caller. Hi, Jane.
George. Greetings, Linda.
Hello.
Hi. I saw there was a, UFO, spaceship, something. We had a house in Charlton, Mass., next to Sturbridge, and I believe it was 2001. I saw a spaceship in the sky above the woods behind my house.
What shape?
It was at night, and it was just a very bright, bright light. And I used to go to the, the sliding glass doors right off the kitchen. There's so much you could see in the woods. And, day or night, it was, deer around the clock. It was amazing. But anyways, I went out to the window, and I looked in the sky because the winter sky is so clear. You can see the stars beautifully. And my eyes automatically went right to this bright, bright, bright light in the sky. And I said, now that's not a star. And as soon as I said that, it took off diagonal from right to left. Within 2 seconds, it was gone. It took off so fast.
Right. And
go ahead.
Well, what's so intriguing about your report and so many people that I've talked to over the past two or three decades is that they will be concentrating on something in the sky that they don't think is a star or a planet. They will be thinking in their mind, I wonder if this is a UFO, and then the light will suddenly do a squiggly move, make a W shape, do a square shape, or simply take off as if there is some, link, connection between whatever this phenomena is and human minds.
And you hear of them being mostly concentrated you know, out in the West, and I never heard much of them being here on the East Coast.
Oh, no, no. The UFO phenomenon is worldwide, global. It depends on any timeline. There's not a state, there's not a province, there's not a hemisphere that has not had many, many reports of this phenomena now for at least 50 or 60 years in terms of the modern age. And then if you go back into other centuries, there's no question that people were reporting the same kind of phenomena, including woodcuts and back to Samaria and Egypt. This is a phenomena that has been with this planet for a very long time, far, far before the 20th century.
Okay, thanks, Jane. Next up, we go to T-Bone in Shiloh, Illinois. Hey, T-Bone.
Hey, I only got a couple seconds left. I just want to ask, to answer off the air, if the encryption the Army guy saw was, if you could identify it and put it on your website. Thank you.
Oh, the symbols that James Peniston drew in his notebook, I have at Earth Files in two of my Bentwaters reports. In fact, I'm looking at it right now on my own computer screen, and it is in the report that is titled Former RAF Bentwaters Staff Sergeant James Peniston Recalls Black Glassy Triangular Craft, Symbols and Missing Time, and it's dated September 24th, which was my time when we started Coast Tonight. And in the report, there is the actual sketch drawing that is from James Peniston's notebook, and it shows a series of, like he diagrammed what he was feeling with his fingers on that black glassy surface. And what intrigues me so much is that there have been suggestions that if this was a textured surface on the surface of that glassy craft, that maybe it had something to do with the propulsion or the time travel, if that's what it is, the time travel ability. And the more I have studied this, the more I have thought about Isaac and the Carrot document in relationship to the strange drones of 2007. Remember, I did an awful lot of reporting on Coast and at Earth Files about those very meticulous and very complicated drawings in which Isaac, before he disappeared, was trying to explain how they learned in Palo Alto in a laboratory. This was given to them as extraterrestrial technology. That's another instance in which that word was used to identify the pieces of hardware that they were working with, as well as these meticulous, strange drawings that also showed up in the drones in 2007. And Isaac was trying to explain to me in emails that they came to the conclusion that the drawings themselves were self-activating software. And the analogy he used, he said, we put our zeros and ones for our computers. We're now putting them currently in hardware, and eventually it might go to bacteria and nerves and all of them, but we're still putting zeros and ones and programming them in something. He said, imagine if you picked up a piece of 8.5 by 11 paper, like you'd put in a typewriter, that kind of paper, and it's blank. Well, the paper, that blank paper, you can physically lift it up with your hand and hold it in the air, but the paper's not going to do that on its own. Until you put the diagrams that have a relationship to a field, the field is unidentified, but that when the patterns themselves in a diagram form are put into a field, the paper would turn into a lifting body. He was using this as an example. And you look at these diagrams that are in my Earth Files report that Jim Peniston drew in his notebook, and he felt with his fingers, and something comes into my mind and says, this is like Isaac's extraterrestrial diagrams and these were on the surface of this glassy craft. It may be that these diagrams themselves become some sort of self-activating software.
Okay, a couple more final calls. West of the Rockies in California we go. Hey, Ron, go ahead.
Thank you, George, and thank you, Linda, for your dedication. I was wondering, are these sightings in the 80s, are these similar or maybe the same incident that Dr. Greer has in his presentation where a craft hovered over a nuclear weapons facility and, like, took each weapon offline despite all of our efforts to keep them on?
No, that's the Robert Salas story from Malmstrom Air Force Base. There were two events, 67 and 68. And it wasn't just Malmstrom. It was Minot in the Air Force Base in Minot, North Dakota. Mm-hmm. And Robert Salas and I spent a whole day together in California after he finally decided that he would talk on the record about what had happened. And he was 80 feet underground in a missile silo at Malmstrom Air Force Base, where we had the Minutemen missiles all over the place. And he's underground, and he gets a phone call from the sabotage alert team security above ground. And one of the guys on the phone is saying to Bob Salas, "My God, we've got this huge glowing red." This was a red one. And this is almost funny. And it's parked over the front gate. And Salas and I talked about this. It was as if whatever this phenomena is, there are strange indications that it paused, like over the gate, like we acknowledge that this is your gate, but we are coming anyway. And that's when it moved. And simultaneously, within a very short period of time, I believe the number in that particular case was 11 nuclear Minutemen went offline. They brought in, I think Boeing was the contractor. They brought them in to do the analysis on what had happened. It's always remained classified. Nobody has ever given any answers, except that I know from my own brother, and I can speak this as firsthand testimony. My brother was a helicopter pilot in Vietnam, and he came back and was stationed at Malmstrom Air Force Base and was there in 75 to 76 when there were so many animal mutilations happening at the same time that there were all of these intrusions in the missile silos. And my brother was at a wing command party when his beeper went off. Everybody's beepers started going off. And this is the famous where there was a sabotage alert team was communicating to the command that they were watching what they said was 300 feet in diameter, at least the size of a football field, glowing orange fluorescent light. And it was sitting down right over what they call kilo number 7, a missile silo. And when the command post, and my brother heard this in his own earphone, ordered the SAT team to go forward and identify the orange glowing mass, there was subordination. They used some choice words and told the command to go, you know what, and that they were not going any closer. And that's when they scrambled jets. The jets got over, and the SAT team was radioing what they were seeing. And as soon as the jets came into their line of sight, this huge orange glowing thing hovering right over the missile silo blinked out. And they said it disappeared, but it couldn't have gone anywhere. There was no time. It just disappeared. The jets circled, and then the jets were called back. And as soon as the jets were out of sight again, this huge thing popped right back on. They said it was like watching a light come on, only it was huge, and then rose up. I think they used the 200,000 feet it Dopplered off of radar. And my brother knew for a fact that they came and took that missile out and took it somewhere. And later he learned that and others told me this too, that the specific zero and one targeting information on the magnetic tape, the Minutemen had magnetic tapes for their guidance system and their targeting, that the target had been specifically changed and nothing else. And I've always wondered, George, what in the world would the target have been changed to by the presence of this huge fluorescent orange thing?
Yeah, there's just so many things that are unknown out there, Linda.
I know.
I mean, and absolutely riveting.
And how can anyone turn away from this without getting answers to what's been going on?
Well, I'm convinced that governments know what's going on. They just don't want us to know about it. And I still can't figure out why, other than, is it the loss of control?
Even that is no justification for the Earth now to be separated into the power greed people who think that they have the right to the secrets of the kingdom of the universe, and all the rest of us have only one responsibility, and that is to work and pay taxes so they can do what they want to do. There's too much of that on this planet now, and something has to change. We've got to get government and the civilian population back into some kind of balance where we actually have some input into what is governing our nations around this planet, and that governments should not be dictating. The government should be serving the people.
Absolutely. And you know, I do not share Stephen Bassett's thoughts that we're going to get disclosure soon. I just don't think it'll happen. We may get whistleblowers, but we're never going to get anything official, Linda.
It may be that the phenomena itself must act first and pull the rug out from under the efforts of human control. And then the issue would be which intelligence might act first.
That's Linda Moulton Howe with her monthly series of reports. Great job, Linda. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesur, Ross Mitchell, George Knapp, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.